Okay, I'm told that we're supposed to start, even though people are not quite coming back in, but starting to come back in. And we are going to try to go as rapidly as possible through these things and then get started so that we get back a little bit on track as to this morning's session. So this is the chapter on the United States. I'm Phil Martin. My co-author is Pia Arrhenius. And remember, what we're doing is doing a chapter in which the structure focuses on what are the numbers and a little bit on the history, how did we get here, and then what are the impacts, and then what are some of the current issues in migration policy. So the a lot of what, you know, a lot of this everybody knows. People who are studying migration already know that the United States is a country with a lot of foreign-born residents. So roughly one out of five of all international migrants, as defined by the United Nations, is in the United States. And according to the UN, we have 50 million foreign-born residents. And part of the reason for that is the United Nations system considers people born in Puerto Rico who moved to the mainland United States to be international migrants, even though they're U.S. citizens at birth. So that gives us always a slightly larger number for the UN than does the official U.S. statistics. And then, of course, we're followed at a distant second, third, and fourth by Germany, Russia, and the United Kingdom, each of whom have roughly 12 million international migrants, remember, as the United Nations defines it. You're out of the country of birth for at least a year for any purpose and any legal status. So in the United States, what makes the country a little bit different, in a lot of ways, but what makes the country a little bit different is the high number of unauthorized foreigners. And it used to be that we would say that the number of unauthorized foreigners in the U.S. was about the same as the total number of international migrants in the number two country of migration, which used to be Russia. So roughly 12 million, now we're down a few million. But the main takeaway is that we have about as many unauthorized foreigners as the next largest countries of migration, and a little over half, or about half, of our unauthorized foreigners are from Mexico. We run lots of polls, and polls pretty much say that most Americans, or traditionally most, the largest single group of people, wanted to reduce legal immigration, or reduce immigration period. Now we're at a point where the largest single group is saying, let's keep migration at current levels. So we don't have quite as much of the anti-migrant feeling in 2019 as we had in many earlier years. Francois already made the point that we have a family-based migration system, which means usually it's around two out of three people come because they're sponsored by family members in the U.S. We have immediate relatives of U.S. citizens, where 50 years ago, this could have been an American soldier going abroad, marrying a local person. Now it is typically foreigners who have become naturalized U.S. citizens sponsoring their parents. One of the things that's important to remember is the U.S. has one of the broadest definitions of family of any country in the world. We consider spouse and children to be immediate relatives, but also parents of naturalized U.S. citizens. We're one of the few countries that allows a U.S. citizen to sponsor adult brothers and sisters. So I'm 40 years old. I sponsor my 38-year-old brother and his family. Why does America have, or why does the United States have so many family-based immigrants? Because we have a very wide definition of family. We also have lots and lots of what we call non-immigrants, temporary visitors. And many of those temporary visitors can work. We have three programs that begin with H, which are the main temporary worker programs. And the big one, which was mentioned before, everyone wants to bring the highly skilled. What was not mentioned is many countries also want to bring those who have money, selling visas, selling passports. But we, our H-1B program was kind of the model in especially around the year 2000. We still issue over 150,000, 180,000 visas recently, because remember, while it's capped, it's uncapped for nonprofits and universities. And there's been a huge proliferation of nonprofit science labs around universities, which basically help you get around the H-1B cap. We have two low-skilled programs that bring in workers. The largest program now in terms of the H programs is the H-2A program, which is to bring in agricultural workers. It's now gotten larger than the H-1B program. And the important point, this is going to come up again when we talk about Australia and to a certain extent Canada as well, most of the foreigners who come into the United States to work temporarily go to work for employers who do not have to look for a local worker. Okay, our biggest single program is called the J program. It's exchange visitor. And remember, we bring in hundreds of thousands of people who go to work in resorts. They're like working holiday makers in Australia and other places. They go to work, and the employers have no obligation to look for a U.S. worker. The only wage requirement is the minimum wage. The same applies to F students, the foreign students. They can work 20 hours during the semester, 40 hours off campus. There's no requirement to look for a U.S. worker. There's no prevailing wage requirement. They can do anything. And it's important to keep in mind that while many of the jobs are seasonal, the numbers of individuals involved are far larger than in what would be called the guest worker programs. The unauthorized come in two categories. An EWI is entry without inspection, that is, between ports of entry, you sneak into the country. An overstay is you come in and you don't leave, or you come in and you violate the terms of your entry by going to work. That's been the big issue. And we'll come back to that. But let me just keep going and remember that we take roughly 1.1 million legal immigrants a year. We started recording immigration in 1820. The only requirement was that the ship's captain had to report how many people and where they came from. And what's interesting is that the two largest sources of immigrants to the U.S. are Germany and Mexico. The difference, of course, being that almost all Germans arrived before 1970, and almost all Mexicans arrived after 1970. But basically, we've brought in 80 million immigrants in the roughly 200 years that we've been recording immigration. It came in waves. We talk about the four waves. We speak English because the first wave was had a lot of Brits. We had the anti-Catholic backlash in the 1840s and 1850s after Ireland in 1848. We had the third wave, which we all romanticize about, and we've got the fourth wave, which started in the mid-60s. I think it's important to remember, even though we're a country of immigration, there has always been backlashes. This so-called Know-Nothing Party elected governors, they elected people to Congress. And remember, what was the whole point? I mean, you stereotype people as drinking whiskey and drinking beer, but what we usually celebrate, of course, is the third wave of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. And it's always important to point out, as people always explain to me when I was on an immigration commission, the whole point of the Statute of Liberty had nothing to do with immigration originally. It was freedom going out from the United States. But back in those days, there was no public money to put it up. And you had to solicit private money in order to raise it. So they got Emma Lazarus to write the poem. And she's the one who changed it to immigrants coming in as opposed to freedom going out. And so that by the time we got to where the people who would have read the first edition of this book were being born in the 1960s and early 70s, we were at a low point in immigration. We had 10 million foreign-born residents. Top five countries accounted for half of them. And if you look around in the countries, there was a lot of European countries that were the main source of immigrants in that state. Italy stands out, for example, as the major source of immigrants. If you just take the South Dakota, we have a president who would like more immigrants from Norway, and Norway was the leading source of immigrants to South Dakota in 1960. We passed this law in 1965. If there's any important point that at least I think politicians and students should know, is it's really hard to predict the future, especially when it concerns immigration. If you look at what was said, the young Ted Kennedy was the main guy shepherding this through. He said, the U.S. will never take 1 million immigrants a year. Well, we've taken 1 million immigrants a year for 20 years. And so, you know, we were completely wrong as to what the effects of the 1965 Immigration Act were. If you look now, you can see that Mexico is the number one source of immigrants in just about every state. We go back to our South Dakota, Ethiopia is the number one source of immigrants to that state today. So it's why? Because they have meatpacking plants and they bring in refugees. So you'll see this kind of chart a lot. We hit that low point in 1970, so the people reading the first edition of this book were those who were born in the early 1970s. Now we're going up, and we will soon get back up toward the historic highs, where we'll get almost to 20% of the people in the United States being born in another country. But the main issue in the United States is this idea that we have a huge number of unauthorized foreigners, a little over half from Mexico, and they've been in the United States a long time. And the question is what to do about it. And perhaps the big thing about the United States is there are roughly 130 million people who were born in Mexico, and 10% of them, 1 out of 10, have more or less moved to the United States. And the question is, what do you do? And the Republic, you know, in any society, one of the reasons you have political parties is they have different priorities. Republicans tend to say the priority is low inflation. The Democrats in the United States say the priority is low unemployment. And if economics offers you a choice between lower inflation or lower unemployment, political parties will align themselves one with the other. Republicans are basically dominated by those who say enforcement to prevent unauthorized migration is the number one priority. And they actually passed a bill 15 years ago to say we're going to first stop unauthorized migration before we do anything else. That led to these big demonstrations, the Day Without Migrants. And so that led in the United States Congress to a bill passing. And so the state of the art in the United States is to say, if you want to deal with unauthorized migration, you have a three-legged stool. And the three-legged stool consists of more enforcement to prevent this from happening again, legalization for some of the people or most of the people already there, and more guest workers. That's the three-legged stool. It passed in 2006. It did not in 2007. It passed in 2013, but nothing has happened. So it's not like there's not like any new discoveries. It's not as if someone wrote a compelling new book saying, here's what we have to do. The basic ideas have been there for 20 years. Meanwhile, with Congress not being able to do anything, we do have the ability for presidents to do things by decree or executive order. And so Mr. Obama took, as it were, the most attractive group among the unauthorized, that is, young people who came to the U.S. before age 18, and in 2012 said, we won't deport you. And the important thing to remember is they are almost all Mexican. And that's the big bar at the top. So at the federal level, there's been this idea of we can't do anything. We're locked, or the people who want enforcement are blocking those who want legalization, can't compromise. And at the state level then, states went different directions. And in Arizona, a border state, the state decided it was going to get very enforcement oriented. So reflecting that one element of this three-pronged stool, in California, the state decided to go in the other direction. So instead of saying we will get enforcement-oriented, make life difficult for these unauthorized foreigners. State of California said, we're going to be friendly to them. And I think the big thing to remember in 2015, I know 2015 was a big year in Europe for foreigners coming in, asylum seekers, is how many driver's licenses went to unauthorized foreigners. I mean, you did not want to have to renew your driver's license in 2015 because half of all driver's licenses issued in California that year went to unauthorized foreigners who were allowed to get driver's licenses for the first time. And of course, 2015 was memorable not only for California issuing lots of driver's licenses, it was also memorable because we had a man come down a tower in New York and start his campaign for the Republican nomination for president by attacking Mexicans as not sending us their best people and all that sort of thing. And he found a fairly effective slogan, which was building a wall. And if you look at the border, you'll notice the red line is the current fence or wall, and the blue dots are the ports of entry, and the brown circles are the share of people apprehended inside the U.S., that is, people who came without entry. And you can see it's really Texas where there's not much of a wall, and part of that has to do with the fact that the border is a river. So once Mr. Trump was elected, he ordered plans within a month for building a wall along the entire border. And it's probably important for those of you who haven't been there to remember that there are obstacles already at the border. And if you look at this man who's in Mexico, he's climbing this. These were actually landing mats that were used for temporary airfields in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And at the top, there's some more wire and leans into Mexico. What you don't see are the people who are about to throw him or rent him blankets and ropes to get over the top when he gets there and hopes to get into the U.S. And so Trump has sort of said, we're going to try to build a barrier along this entire 2,000-mile border. Most Americans actually don't support the building of the barrier. I mean, opinion polls say it's something that some people want, not most. But probably the current issues in the United States, if anything, are perhaps driving more support toward Mr. Trump and a wall, because what we have is an upsurge of Central American asylum seekers. And the main issue here is that under the United States, it's actually under a court settlement that was reached in the 1990s, we don't hold people under 18 more than 20 days in detention. And so if you arrive with a child, the chances are that you will be processed and then released. And you will be given a court date to decide to go before a judge and explain why you should get asylum. And that court date is normally 2, 3, or 4 years in the future. During that 2 or 3 or 4 years, your children can go to school. And in a state like California, they can get free health care and a number of other services. And you will get a work permit, most likely, within 6 months to start working legally. So even if in the end you don't get asylum, and about 80% of the people are rejected, it gives you 2 or 3 or 4 years, in many cases, of a chance to get some U.S. education and to do some work. So Trump was very opposed to this, and that's why last summer there was an effort to prosecute everybody who came in illegally and then applied for asylum. Normally, you were sentenced to whatever time you had already been detained and then deported, but it did mean separating the children from the parents. There was backlash against that. And so that is what then changed that policy. So where are we now? We have people that were starting to come in caravans through Mexico. So that made it easier to get through Mexico, but it also made for nice television. And that really got Mr. Trump and his supporters very upset. And the idea was that if you could get in, I mean, remember, this is not like a secret sort of thing. There are Facebook pages by smugglers advertising, come now before Trump builds his wall. So incentives actually work. People have an pay their $5,000. It's cheaper to come with a child than it is to come solo into the U.S. And so what Mr. Trump has decided to do is to use a trade policy to manage migration. So what's the trade policy? Well, Mr. Trump has discovered that presidents have a lot of authority in national security. And if we say the issue is a security threat, that allows the president to get around a whole lot of other things. And so what he has announced is that if Mexico does not stop the Central Americans, he would levy a 5% tariff on all goods coming from Mexico. That's a serious threat. It's about $1 billion a day in trade. And so that means $50 million a day goes into tariff coffers. And Mexico's economy is heavily dependent on exports to the United States. Well over 80% of their exports, long lines of trucks coming into the US. And of course, the industry that would be the most affected would be the auto industry, because autos are a huge success in Mexico. Mexico is up to about the sixth largest producer of autos and the fifth largest exporter, ahead of South Korea. Tomatoes, over half the tomatoes eaten in the United States come from Mexico. So what we have is a situation in which the goal of the current president is to manage migration in a very restrictive way. And the president is proving that he can do that by invoking security clauses where it gives him an awful lot of authority. So let me end just by saying, this was the official highway sign as you're going from San Diego into Tijuana. And what it was doing is warning you, be careful, because there are people trying to come across the six-lane freeway, and every year some people were killed. Now, if you're in favor of migration, if you're in favor of being generous, liberal rights, you say, let the people in. Those are the kind of risk takers the United States needs. Those are the kind of people who built the country. If you're opposed, of course, you take the same sign, but you draw an entirely different conclusion. You say, you don't know who these people are. They could be terrorists. And so that's why you can have the same magazine in the same year drawing exactly the opposite conclusions from the phenomenon that you're observing. One says you've got to legalize the people here. The other says you've got to build a wall to prevent people from coming. So the United States is a country with a lot of immigrants, but it's a very conflicted country. There are two sides, and we can talk about gaps, but there are two sides on many, many issues, whether it's climate change or environment or economics. And at least on the migration front, the two sides are now more or less deadlocked, with an activist president who's trying to take this supertanker, which is the migration system, and move it from headed in this direction to headed in a different direction. Will he succeed? It's hard to know, but he certainly is going to change the direction of the ship. If it was moving in a rights direction, is going to move in a non-rights direction, at least for the next year and a half or so. Thank you, and I'll stop there.
All right, well, good morning. It's a great pleasure to be here. We've been looking forward to this workshop for a long time. Thank you, Francois, for hosting. So great to be here. And I'm filling in the rest of the chapter here with my co-author, Phil Martin. And so I'm handling sort of more the economic and fiscal impacts of immigration. And I think Phil presented more of the trends. I'll just quickly maybe just show a couple of trend graphs that'll give you an idea sort of where we're thinking, where our thinking is on current trends. And as you know, the title of the chapter is Wither U.S. Immigration. So I think one introductory sort of chart which gives you an idea of what we're thinking is that we've had really a shortfall in immigration in the U.S. Relative to employment growth since the Great Recession. And so what I tried to do here is construct in blue a flow of immigrant workers each year, and I'm contrasting it to U.S. employment growth so that you can see after the recession, immigration never really recovered. And so it's sort of there's a gap, a different kind of a gap from Jim's gap, but still a relevant gap in the sense that immigration has not really kept up with U.S. employment growth. And so really we are in the United States at historically tight labor markets with record low unemployment rates. So this just illustrates a similar concept. So where have we seen the decline in immigration in the United States over the last 10-20 years or so, and it's really been overwhelmingly among illegal immigration. The yellow line here is apprehensions along the southwest border. And the current surge that President Trump is very upset about is sort of the dotted extension there at the very, very end. So this is plotted, normalized by the working age population in the United States. So it is a normalized measure. But nevertheless, it shows you that despite all the hype in the media, it really is not nearly as large an inflow, especially not on a relative scale as we saw in the 2000s or in the 1990s. So there really is no comparison. Of course, it is a different kind of migration, which Phil was pointing out, is asylum seekers are quite different from sort of your traditional undocumented workers. So in the 1990s, the 2000s, we had a lot of construction workers from Mexico. And you get the sense that the president would feel more comfortable about those construction workers. He's more comfortable with that idea than the idea of women and children. And so we can get back to that, but certainly I think Phil directed some of his comments toward that change. What really is looming for the United States labor force is the retirement of the baby boomers. So what I've circled here is research from the Pew Research Center that shows that this divides labor force growth over the decades that I'm showing into immigrants, the children of immigrants and natives. And you can see from what I've circled the last 20 years that really immigrants and the children of immigrants have made up half of labor force growth over the last 20 years. But going forward, they'll make up all the growth in the labor force because of the retirement of the baby boomers. So immigration, more than ever before, is directly linked to growth in the labor market. And so we really haven't seen that probably for a century. So very interesting development and backdrop for the rest of the discussion in the chapter. What are the labor market effects of immigration? Certainly, the labor force grows. As the labor force grows with immigration, GDP rises. Like I said, immigrants have accounted for about one half of labor force growth since 1996 in the U.S. The problem with the increase in GDP from immigration is that it's really not equally divided among workers and sort of capitalists, if you will. The immigration surplus is not shared equally. Wages fall for competing workers, substitutable native workers, see a decline in their wages in the short run. And then those who hold capital, businesses, for example, as Jim was mentioning earlier, the business interests, certainly landowners, the return to capital rises, so they benefit in the short run. Consumers also benefit, of course. We benefit from the greater services and products that are offered at cheaper rates. There's, of course, other labor market impacts that improve the efficiency of markets, and there's potentially large effects on productivity growth, although we associate those more with high-skilled immigration than with low-skilled immigration, as was pointed out earlier. So what are some of those efficiency-enhancing characteristics of immigrants that lead to better sort of functioning of labor markets? One of them is that immigrants more readily move to growing areas in the country relative to natives. So they're more likely than natives to move to growing areas. They also tend to complement native workers at the high and low ends of the skill distribution. They fill jobs that natives shun. A lot of those, as Phil discussed, some of those are going to be in agriculture. That's a good example. And I think Phil's work has also showed that what are some of the side effects of this type of immigration. For example, now we talk a lot about technological adoption, not just in agriculture, but in other industries as well. If you have plentiful labor, you're going to slow technological adoption. So that's another interesting aspect of immigration, especially now. Immigrants also start businesses at a higher rate, so they're more entrepreneurial. Of course, what we have to point out whenever we say that is that that's partly driven by necessity. And you know, these are not all sort of Silicon Valley high-tech startups. A lot of these is like my cleaning lady selling gold. That's her business. So some of these are low value added, low productivity businesses, but they're still entrepreneurs. High-skilled immigrants, a different case. Lots of research showing there that they innovate and patent at a higher rates than native, this research shows this for the United States. This just shows the correlation between immigration and job growth. So I've just mapped out here, again, normalized job growth and immigration. You could just, you draw sort of a regression line through these dots, you would see it's just a positively sloped line that shows that in the United States, the states that grow the fastest in terms of employment are also the ones who get the most immigrants. And that's just an important correlation if you expect that immigrants are contributing to labor force growth. If you look at similar labor force numbers, but you look by education, you can see that here we're sort of splitting them into natives and foreign-born in terms of the growth of the labor force over the last 25 years. And we're looking at foreign-born growth in red and native-born is sort of the orange. And you can see that at the high end of the skill distribution, both numbers are growing. At the low end of the education distribution, native-born labor force is shrinking in absolute terms, and the foreign-born labor force is growing. That is really the only growth factor at the bottom of the skill distribution. What that means is that over time, our low-skill labor force in the United States, these columns are the percent of the labor force in each skill category that's made up of immigrants. What it shows you is that 52% of workers with less than a high school degree are immigrants in the United States. In Texas, it's closer to 60%. And then on the opposite extreme, of course, a higher than average share of workers with advanced degrees, PhDs and so forth, are also immigrants. So we have a disproportionate representation of immigrants at the extremes of the education distribution. That's actually what you want from an efficiency and a market's perspective, because the bulk of the US labor force is middle skilled, so they're concentrated in the middle. So if you're having an immigration policy, you should bring them in at the extremes if you look at this from a market's perspective. So the other thing I wanted to just point out on high-skilled immigration is we now have some data that tells us college majors, and if you compare college majors of foreign-born workers with college degrees, you can see on the left that 46% of these foreign-born workers were majored in the STEM field, so science, technology, and engineering and math majors, compared to 28% of the native-born. So among the high-skilled, there's a real bias towards the STEM majors, which is what Phil was pointing out with the H-1Bs. Of course, the H-1B visa is geared towards STEM workers, and so that's a very key mechanism. But the reason I point this out is there is really this link that's been drawn between STEM immigration and productivity growth by Chad Jones, who's a macroeconomist at Stanford. He estimates 50% of total factor productivity growth in post-war period is due to innovation. And he proxies for this intensity of R&D or innovation by the increase in the science and engineering workforce. And if you just sort of do the math, immigrants have made up 80% of growth in these occupations since 1990. So if you just follow that through, then as much as 40% of productivity growth since 1990 can be attributed to the immigration of STEM workers. So a very clear or suggestive link here of the link between STEM workers, foreign STEM workers, and productivity growth. Okay, so what are the effects on native workers of this immigration? So research, just to summarize, finds small negative effects on low-skilled native workers that compete with immigrants. It's really concentrated among high school dropouts and prior immigrants. That's really where the research ends up. I cite, there's little empirical evidence of adverse wage effects among high-skilled workers. That's also partly an artifact, I think, of the fact that we've had historically in the United States so much low-skilled immigration. All the papers have been on low-skilled immigration. But for example, here is a summary of this labor market literature in the National Academies report that came out in 2016. And these are sort of just the point estimates from different types of studies, spatial studies and skill cell studies, that show you the negative wage impact of immigration on substitutable native workers. And in every one of these cases, these estimates are for high school dropouts or prior immigrants. So the conclusion of the National Academies was that there is no overall negative wage impact of immigration on US workers. That was the conclusion. So it's concentrated among these subgroups. Now, the other key about the wage effects of immigration is that in the long run, there should be no negative wage effect. Why should there be no negative wage effect in the long run? Because in the long run, capital adjusts. So once the capital to labor ratio is restored, average wage is restored. And I brought some graphs that we don't have a lot of time. But basically, here you can see that when the immigrants come in, the blue line shifts out and you get a new labor supply. And as a result, the wage, you're operating at a lower equilibrium wage, W1, after immigration. But in the long run, labor demand should shift up because once the return to capital rises, there should be more business investment. Business investment should generate labor demand. Labor demand shifts the labor demand curve up and restores the wages to where they should be. Even George Borges believes this. This is from his book. It's true. This is from his book. So I've circled sort of the conclusion of this chart, and I even have the page so you can go and see for yourself. But if you see the long run, in the bottom row, the long run wage effect of all on all workers of immigration, this is 1990 to 2010, it's zero, according to his model. It's slightly negative, negative 3% in the short run, zero in the long run. Now, Giovanni Perry and co-authors came along and used the same model and showed that we don't even, because here you have a negative wage effect on native workers, minus 3.2 in the short run. Here that goes away. How does it go away? Well, because you assume complementarities between natives and immigrants. And when you do that, the negative wage effect goes away. The problem is somebody has to sustain the negative wage effect. And in this case, it's the prior immigrants. So whether you, if you want to say that natives don't suffer in the short run from negative wage effects, then you're going to have to say that prior immigrants did, because the demand curve is downward sloping, as George likes to remind us. So anyway, but in the long run, so the argument really in economics come down to the first point here, how long is the long run? That's what I found on the National Academies panel. That was the big debate. So some economists said in the long run, we're all dead, like Keynes said. But of course, some of us more optimistic economists said that the long run can be very short. It can be a year, it can be 2 years. One economist even said it can be anticipatory. So business investment can adjust before the immigrants arrive on the assumption that they're coming. So that was really where the discussion came down. Okay, so I'm moving quickly. Because the other effect of immigrants is the fiscal impact. So we can argue that the economic impact is largely positive. At least from an economic perspective on labor markets and so forth, that any negative wage and employment effects are short-run phenomenon, not long-run phenomenon, and so forth. But we're still stuck with the fiscal impact. So what does it show? Well, first of all, what is the fiscal impact? It's really, I think, Christian, you were discussing it earlier. The contribution in taxes minus consumption of publicly provided goods and services. Of course, in the U.S. case, and I think in other countries as well, is a federal, state, and local impact. We pay taxes at each level. We consume services from each provider. The other thing that you have to watch out for when you calculate a fiscal impact is the role of public goods. In the U.S. case, the big sort of elephant in the room is it's really two things. It's the national debt, so paying interest on the national debt, which is absolutely enormous in the U.S. And the other is the defense spending. So it's another enormous budget item that if you assign immigrants as soon as they come into the country their share of the national debt and their share of defense spending, it's going to be negative. It's going to be a negative fiscal impact because those budget items are so large. It's key how you treat public goods. We don't have a long discussion of that in paper, but it does tie into what I'm going to show you. There's the other thing about fiscal impacts. You can look at fiscal impacts in the cross section. So today, how are we all contributing versus consuming today? But that's going to turn out to be completely a function of your age. So that's not a good way to do it. The better way to do it is doing a dynamic long-run fiscal impact Of course, the problem there is we don't know what the future looks like, so we have to make a lot of assumptions about the future and how immigrants are going to assimilate. This is what the fiscal impact looks like in the cross-section by age. And the three lines are for immigrants, children of immigrants, and natives. Again, this is from the National Academies report. But what you can see is everyone is negative up until about the age 22. Children are expensive, and certainly for parents and for the government. And then everyone is a net negative in their old age. And it doesn't much make a difference whether you're immigrant or native, as you can see. Everyone is sort of a contributor in their prime working years. The interesting thing was, these are the latest numbers from the National Academies that we cite in the book. And the interesting thing is that if you use the bottom line, which really is, I think that row is the better row because it includes just the marginal cost of public goods, not the average cost of public goods. And then you can see that in the most recent cohort of immigrants, which is sort of the first circle in the bottom row, that immigrants pay 93% of what they consume in public goods and services. If you look, compare that to natives, which is the last circle in the bottom row, you can see that natives pay 77% of what they consume in public services. So by the current accounting, and the reason it's like this, this is a far brighter picture than the one that was in the last issue of Controlling Immigration. Because why? Because immigrants are much more skilled now to the U.S. Illegal immigration has dried up, as I showed you in the first slide and as Phil showed you in his slides. So illegal immigration is way down. Low-skilled immigration is way down. We have historic shortages of low-skilled workers. And so because the stream of immigrants is so skewed now to high-skilled, they're actually not nearly the fiscal drain that they looked like they were in the 1990s. And in fact, natives who have grown older and more expensive are a larger drain. And of course, on net, everyone is a drain in the United States because we have a huge budget deficit. So this is just so you can compare sort of, this is the long run impact. So that before was the cross section, this is the long run. So over your lifetime, are you contributing positively or negatively? And so if you look at all immigrants, that first, you know, the negative 5,000 over your lifetime, that is with the public goods assumption. And so that's accounting for public goods. So yes, immigrants are a net negative, but a small net negative over their lifetimes as a whole group in the United States. But then if you look at the recent immigrants, they're a huge positive. So each recent immigrant, even if you force them to pay in the calculation their average cost of public goods, they're $173,000 net benefit in net present value to the U.S. government and state and local, everything added up. So that the reason recent immigrants are so different is because they are so skilled. So just to conclude then, since we have little time. So basically, U.S. immigrants today are relatively fewer compared to the labor force and the population. They're more high skilled and they're more likely to be legal. And there are economic and fiscal benefits that we can point to of this change in the nature of immigration to the U.S. Low-skilled immigration is greatly diminished. There's some benefit in this for low-skilled native workers, particularly in the short run. But there is, of course, on the cost side, there's less growth. There's less benefit for consumers, businesses, investment, and, of course, the would-be migrants that weren't allowed to come. Really, if you look forward, growth, tight labor markets, the recent tax cuts, which are not part of these calculations, the aging population really calls for more immigration, not less. But again, there the government has a role. And again, the current policies in the U.S. in particular has lots of adverse consequences for immigrants and their families that we didn't really have time to go and discuss here.